today. We'll give you a shout out if you tell us why you're the special one. Lee in Watford says 45 today, not special, but it would be great if you read it out.
Which I just have.
It's a very special day now.
Yeah.
And happy birthday to my husband, Tim, 52 today, with love from Viv and sons, Jack and Tom. Happy birthday, Tim. Right, if it's your birthday, tell us why we should mark it out specially for you, please. 85058. Send us a voice note as well. Sing us happy birthday, whatever you want to do.
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
And here's the 5 Live news this morning. The UK, as well as 10 other countries and the European Union, have signed a joint statement calling for a 21-day ceasefire on the Lebanon-Israeli border. It comes as the UN Security Council held an emergency session to discuss the situation, which the Secretary-General Antonio Guterres described as all hell breaking loose. The UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy also addressed the session.
The United Kingdom condemns Hezbollah's attacks on Israel over the last 11 months, which have driven more than 60,000 people from their homes. There was no justification for these attacks. They have brought misery to ordinary people in Lebanon and Israel, and they have done nothing to end the conflict in Gaza or secure Palestinian statehood.
The BBC has heard testimony from a woman who said she was raped by the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed, when she was 16 after being made to have an intrusive medical examination. Harrods' new owners have previously apologised unreservedly and said the actions of Mr Al-Fayed were that of an individual intent on abusing his power.
Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. Customers directed to websites containing what the company called inappropriate material before their Wi-Fi was suspended. An investigation into what happened is underway.
The mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, is facing federal criminal charges. The details haven't been revealed, but he's under investigation for campaign funding violations. He would be the first sitting mayor of the city to be charged. He insists he's done nothing wrong.
If I'm charged, I know I'm innocent. I will request an immediate trial so the New Yorkers can hear the truth. New Yorkers know my story. They know where I come from. I have been fighting injustice my entire life. That fight has continued as your mayor.
The BBC understands that one of the richest people in the world, Elon Musk, has not been invited to the government's International Investment Summit. Sources say it's because of the billionaire's social media posts during last month's riots, which were described at the time by ministers as utterly deplorable. Next month's summit aims to attract tens of billions of pounds of investment. The BBC has asked for Elon Musk's response, but has heard nothing so far.
And an independent think tank has suggested a radical overhaul of student loans and university funding in England to make the system fairer. The Higher Education Policy Institute wants to see better maintenance support and a national insurance charge for graduate employers. The government has yet to set out its long-term plans for funding universities in England.
Right, let's find out what's happening with our sport today. A busy night of football last night, Katie.
Yeah, morning, Rach. Morning, Claire. They looked like they wanted it more, so Christian Eriksen, that can't be right. That was following Manchester United's 1-1 draw with Twente in their opening Europa League match. Eriksen scored before then being caught in possession himself, leading to their equaliser. He says, "We didn't want to lose, but it does feel like one." In the League Cup, Diogo Jota and Cody Gakpo each scored twice as Liverpool began their title defence by coming from behind. They thrashed West Ham 5-1 though at Anfield. Arsenal cruise past League One Bolton, also winning that one 5-1. And the draw for the fourth round has been done. That was last night. Liverpool are going to travel to Brighton. Tottenham will host Manchester City. And if you want to check out any of the fixtures, they are all on the BBC Sport website and app. And in cricket, England's Test captain Ben Stokes is on track, says the ECB, to be part of the series against Pakistan that begins in 12 days, start of October. He's been out of action with a hamstring injury since the start of August.
Katie, thank you. Simon's here with the weather.
Good morning. Yeah, another very wet day for many parts of England and Wales. We've got different areas of rain. So let's start off across northern parts of England, actually, where the rain is very persistent in the northeast of England. That could cause some localised flash flooding problems. The rain is going to eventually ease off to the south across northern England, but very wet across parts of Wales, the Midlands, eastern England this morning as well. Some brighter skies developing later on, but here as well as across southern England, we're going to see the risk of some heavy and thundery showers developing into the afternoon. Lots of water in a short space of time. That could lead on to some flooding issues. So, yeah, some pretty hazardous conditions across England and Wales today. Temperatures getting to about 13 to 18 degrees. Scotland, Northern Ireland, very, very wet across Northern Ireland, central southern Scotland. That rain is going to ease to the south. There'll be some sunnier skies developing across Scotland. And with that, some colder weather coming in as well. Temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius.
And let's get the travel news. Ellie's here. Morning, Ellie.
Morning. And we're starting on the M1 southbound around Hertfordshire. Two lanes are closed at the morning before, this morning before junction 8 at Hemel Hempstead. There's a broken down car there, which has caused those delays, but it is slow back to junction 10 at the Luton Airport Spur Road at the moment. The M25 anti-clockwise, it's closed because of an accident between junction 28 at Brentwood to junction 27. You've got congestion a couple of miles from junction 30 at the moment around Lakeside, and the A12 Brentwood bypass, that is back to junction 13 at the moment, so that is going to be slow. And the M2 westbound, that is closed because of an accident at junction 1. You've got 2 miles of queue in traffic and congestion to the Medway Viaduct. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
And it's Thursday morning. It's Claire McDonald and Rachel Burden here with you this morning. 5 minutes past seven. The UK has joined 10 other countries in calling for a 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. The statement followed an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, during which the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said all hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. He also called for an immediate end to hostilities.
Listening and watching at the UN in New York was our political editor Chris Mason, and he sent us this voice note.
Hi Rachel, morning Claire from New York, where the Prime Minister has been meeting all sorts of world leaders, some of them for the first time since he won the German election. And the two big theatres of war, if you like, that he's dealing with on the international stage, that the United Nations here is dealing with on the international stage, Ukraine, he's met President Zelensky, and then also Lebanon. And overnight, whilst you've been asleep, there has been a statement, a joint statement that the UK is a signatory to. It was put out by the White House. There was a little blip, actually, when it was first published, because the UK's name was missed off it, much to the consternation of quite a few Brits over here. It rapidly appeared a few minutes later. A typo was blamed for it. So a joint statement by the United States, Australia, Canada, the European Union, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and yes, the UK, that's saying that there should be an immediate 21-day ceasefire across the Lebanon-Israel border to provide space for diplomacy, they say. So plenty of effort here to try and make it clear that the conflict needs to stop between Lebanon and Israel, but an expectation too that it is actually likely to get more significant, to escalate, to get more dangerous and worse.
So that was Chris Mason talking to us from New York. We're going to be talking to Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's chief international editor, a bit later on in the programme. If you have any sort of specific questions about what's going on at the moment in northern Israel, southern Lebanon, on the border there, how it all began, how it's likely to play out, then please feel free to send them in. No question too daft, to be honest. It's a subject that a lot of us will probably feel that we're not massively well briefed on, and can be very confusing in the sort of the long history of conflict in that region. So 85058 if you want to send us any questions at all. Israel's most senior general has told his troops to prepare for a ground offensive across the border. So that feels almost inevitable now. We also earlier spoke to Anne Bougie, who is British and lives in Lebanon. This is what she told us.
It's difficult, to say the least, but where we are on the east side of the city, we are relatively okay, but our neighbours on the west part of the city have suffered dreadfully in the last 10 days or so. And of course, in the south of the country, areas of which are only 40 kilometres away, it has just been horrendous for months.
Yeah. When you say with the recent escalation, people you know in the east, what has been happening there? What are they telling you?
Well, I only know what I have seen on television, because we don't have much contact between east and west. because of my situation with my husband, I'm at home most of the time. But, I mean, it's just horrendous that these targeted missiles that have killed so many innocent people and injured thousands more, left so many people homeless. It's awful. But the overall feeling is that there is so much tension and fear in the air. You can taste it. It's very real and it's very distressing.
We can speak now to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Morning, Frank.
Good morning, Rachel.
Israel, it seems, is set up for a ground invasion in southern Lebanon. Do you think that that is almost inevitable now?
Well, if they can't reach a ceasefire, and that's what allies, Western allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, are all calling for, this 21-day ceasefire. But I can't see Israel agreeing to that because they think they've got Hezbollah on the back foot and they're going to want to press home their advantage. Back in 2006, the Israel and Hezbollah fought a full-scale war that lasted 34 days. The Israeli Air Force said, we can do this from the air, we've got this, leave it to us. And they couldn't. And there's a limit to what they can achieve from the air because Hezbollah's got a big network of tunnels just as Hamas has in Gaza. They've got a lot of stuff buried underground. And eventually they went in on the ground. Neither side won. It was a very inconclusive fight. So there is a sense, I think, in the Israeli military that they are going to have to go in on the ground, they think, which a lot of people say is going to be disastrous for Lebanon. It's also going to be if that happens, it's going to be a very tough fight for the Israelis because this is Hezbollah's own turf. They know the terrain. They are specialists in light, small, two-person teams. They set up ambushes using quite sophisticated weaponry. And it's not going to be a pushover for the Israelis. But, of course, the people who will suffer most are going to be the Lebanese civilian population who've already suffered hundreds of casualties from this fighting so far.
Yeah, as we were just hearing from Anne there, even though she's quite far away from where all this is happening, what would be the Israelis' end game with an invasion like this?
Well, they made it very clear what their aims are, which is to stop the cross-border fire coming from Hezbollah so that their own residents, about 60,000 of whom have been displaced on the Israeli side of the border, so that they can return to their homes, their moshavs, their farms, and their businesses. To do that, they need to push Hezbollah back about 30 kilometres north of the border, which, when the war ended in 2006, there was a UN Security Council resolution, number 1701, which stipulated that Hezbollah had to stay north of the Litani River, 30k north of the border. But Hezbollah has crept south, and ever since October the 8th, the day after the Hamas raid into Israel last year, Hezbollah, in support of its Palestinian allies in Gaza, has been lobbing rockets, missiles and drones into Israel. So the domestic pressure, political pressure on the Israeli government to do something about this has been building. And eventually the Israeli government has said, OK, we're going to deal with this. And that's what this is about. But it's very hard to see how this is going to happen unless there is an agreed deal, a ceasefire. If it's military, this could go on a long time. You know, look, when Israel went into Gaza after the October the 7th massacre, I don't think they envisaged they'd still be there 11 months on, and Hamas still hasn't been completely eliminated. So this could be an open-ended, very long, very bloody, messy incursion into Lebanon. Just to remind people, Israel was in Lebanon for 18 years, from 1982 to 2000.
Yeah. I mean, a long history of conflict, of course, between these two nations. But can Israel maintain this kind of military strategy on two fronts while it's got the war in Gaza going on at the moment as well?
Well, it says it can. And don't forget, there is a third front that has yet to completely erupt, but could, and that's the West Bank, which is extremely unstable. You've got ongoing persecution of Palestinians there by settlers illegally, who are trying to push them out of their homes, often with the Israeli police and army just looking the other way or even helping them. And if that erupts too, then Israel could find itself on three fronts. So no, I don't think it can fight two, certainly not three, fronts effectively. This can grind on, and it'll probably get unconditional support from the United States, but it's a really unsatisfactory situation, this. Israel says, look, we were attacked on October the 7th, and that was a horrific assault, the worst on them since the Holocaust. But the way Israel has conducted its campaign in Gaza, killing over 41,000 people, mostly civilians, has cost it a lot of international support. And what they're doing now in Lebanon is drawing also a lot of criticism because of the high civilian toll, death toll. And if they go in on the ground and have an open-ended invasion, that is going to be very costly, very bloody, and it's going to, again, increase the isolation of Israel internationally.
Frank, thank you so much for your time. Frank Gardner, who is our security correspondent, and the point, of course, Frank makes there about the Americans giving them their pretty much undiluted support is in part because of the presidential election there, no one wanting to rock the boat. And I guess when we talk about all these countries coming together, 10 nations and then the EU as well, so significant number of different countries calling for this 21-day ceasefire, a lot of you may be thinking, well, what's the point in that? Nothing seems to get achieved when the UN puts pressure on a country like Israel. But we'll talk more about that throughout the programme. And as I've already mentioned, Jeremy Bowen, Chief International Editor, will be here on the show after 8:30 this morning. So if you've got any questions there from anything that our conversation with Frank has raised, anything you don't quite understand about this conflict, then you can please feel free to ask them of Jeremy, 850-58, and we'll put as many of those to him as we can. It's 16 minutes past 7.
On Radio 4. The more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Five Live Breakfast. In my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
Today's In My Opinion is about the NHS and the language we use when we criticise it.
Hi Rach. Hi Claire. Roy Lilly here, health commentator and former NHS Trust chair. In my opinion, saying the NHS is broken is damaging and unhelpful. Yesterday, Health Secretary Wes Streeting, in his speech to Labour's conference, said he wouldn't back down from using the phrase. He should. I sort of understand he's using it during the election campaign as a soundbite, but the persistent claim the NHS is broken, now used by others in a wider context, is very unhelpful. Who wants to work in a broken organisation with its overtones of despair and pointlessness? If the NHS is broken, it's politics and politicians who've broken it.
Five Live Breakfast. The voice of the UK.
Well, we'll speak to health commentator Roy Lilly. You heard him there later in the show, but we want your take on this. Do we need to stop bashing the NHS? Does calling it broken insult the millions of workers and patients in the NHS right now? Or maybe using provocative language, that's the only way we can describe the urgency of the situation, which is certainly what the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, thinks. Jonathan and Billericay. Morning, Jonathan. No one questions how remarkable the people who work in the NHS are, but accessing them is often a nightmare. We've been fighting for almost a year to get a diagnosis of dementia for our dad and have only recently managed to get any sort of appointment scheduled. And that was after I unfortunately had to stage something of a sit-in. Every nurse and doctor I've ever dealt with has been amazing. Getting to see them via the appointment system is an absolute nightmare. It is broken, and the people who dedicate their lives to working in it need support, not wooden spoons and clapping. And Jeff in South Brum says, I had a total hip replacement last year. I'm walking again. The staff Well, excellent. Yeah, so your views, 85058, or send us a voice note, 08085 909 693.
Jeremy Bowen's coming up to answer all your questions about what's happening in Lebanon and Israel. And then we're going to sort of talk about a very sad story. And actually, these kinds of stories are coming up with really worrying frequency. This is a woman who's died after undergoing a non-surgical Brazilian butt lift. Now, the difference is that she died here in the UK. Often we hear about things going wrong abroad. We'll have more on that after 8 o'clock.
And babies. Today is the day for peak births, peak babies. There will be around 2,000 babies born later today. Now, that is 200 more than the average. And when you get the calendar out, it's basically what people get up to over Christmas. That has something to do with it. So we want to know, if it is your birthday today, happy birthday. But why should we say happy birthday to you over the radio? For example, this texter, Patrick in Preston. Hey, Rachel and Claire, my son Sebastian is 10 today. We didn't think he'd survive when he was born. He had a condition called pyloric stenosis and had to be operated on at 2 weeks old. He pulled through and here we are. Happy birthday, Seba. That is from Patrick and from all of us.
And Dan in Bristol says, very weird to listen to the radio and hear things about September 26th birthdays. When it is your birthday, it's mine today. It was my sister's yesterday, but we're 5 years apart. Our parents love Christmas, clearly. It's also our first birthdays as parents, me at 37 and her at 42. Better late than never, he says. Congratulations to you both.
Yes, and happy birthday. Keep those texts coming in, 85058. Now, the BBC has heard harrowing testimony for the first time from a woman who says she was raped by the former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, when she was just 16. Kate, which isn't her real name, says she was also made to have intrusive medical examinations. Her testimony is spoken by an actor here. And just a warning that what you're about to hear contains details of a serious sexual nature.
When I first started working for Mohammed Al-Fayed, he soon started asking me inappropriate questions, like, did I have a boyfriend? Had I been sexually active? Well, I was only 16 years old and I was a virgin, and he soon discovered that. So it was organised for me to see Dr. Anne Coxon of Harley Street for a medical examination. This was offered to me as a perk for working in the chairman's office. Dr. Coxon asked me to do an internal examination. She wanted to test for HIV and STDs, but I said that I wasn't sexually active yet, so therefore it was unnecessary. My concerns were brushed off and I was told that an internal examination was necessary. One night he summoned me to his apartment. Well, I was scared, but I knew that I didn't have an option to say no, and he started to pressurise me into having sex with him, but I kept saying no, and then his mood changed. And the threat started, and he had become angry. The doors were locked and I couldn't get out. That's when he raped me. It's affected so many areas of my life. But having to live with the deep shame of what happened to me from when I was young, being paranoid about walking by myself at night, not trusting men in any form, they're just to name but a few.
Let's talk now to Mike Radford, who is executive producer of Al-Fayed Predator at Harrods. Thank you for joining us, Mike.
Thanks very much.
OK, let's go back to the beginning then. Remind us what we know about the situation at Harrods.
I've been doing this about a year now, and Kate's sort of genuinely shocking account arose directly from the investigation we've been carrying out for our documentary. We've been investigating the conduct of Mohammed Al-Fayed, who listeners may recall formerly owned Harrods. Our investigation uncovered testimony from more than 20 female ex-employees who say the billionaire who died last year actually assaulted or raped them. And that was a week ago. And today, like so many days since, there have been further revelations about the abuse he carried out.
I've watched the documentary. It's incredibly powerful. What sort of impact has it had on people speaking out? Because we reported on this earlier in the week that, you know, once that was aired, more people came forward, didn't they?
Yes, it certainly brought more people to want to come forward with allegations. There's a group of lawyers who are talking to claimants, and they've had around 200 people contact them. I had some new figures last night, and the BBC have had many, many come through to us, and there are more each day. And they tell a story we are now sadly familiar with. You know, many say they were abused by Mohammed Al-Fayed. But beyond the new people coming forward, it's also given people who he had spoken to during the making of the documentary the confidence to come forward and tell their story. And Kate, the extract of whose story we just heard, is one of those women.
So the woman that we're hearing from today, as you said, Kate, she hasn't spoken out before, has she?
No, this is the first time she's spoken openly, and we can report what she said. You know, we've been in contact with her for a number of months during the making of the documentary. But like many survivors, speaking publicly is, as you can imagine, a huge step. These are the most traumatic experiences for them, whose consequences reverberate for decades afterwards. And as a result, many are understandably reticent. But now she wants to give more details of what happened to her after seeing the women speak out in the documentary. And she says she wants people to fully understand, in her words, just how much of a monster Fayed truly was.
What have Harrod's lawyers had to say then in response to the allegations so far?
They hadn't responded to the ones this morning, but the current owners said they were utterly appalled by the allegations and that his victims have been failed, for which the store sincerely apologised. They added that the Harrods of today is a very different organisation to the one owned and controlled by Al-Fayed between 1985 and 2010. And in terms of people bringing claims, they have their own settlement process in place to ensure, as they say, swift and impartial outcomes for the victim.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us. Mike Ragford, the executive producer of Al-Fayed Predator at Harrods. Now, if you have been affected by issues in this story, there is a range of organisations and websites that can offer you advice and support, and you can find them listed on the BBC's Action Line website. You just go here, bbc.co.uk/actionline, and you can connect with those organisations there. And just a reminder, you can watch Mike's documentary. It is on the BBC iPlayer now. 26 minutes past seven.
My mic. There's my mic. Happy birthday if you're born on this day. There is a bit of a spike in births on this day. 200 more than the 2,000 that are normally born. No, sorry, 2,000 on average, which is 200 more than are normally born on an average day.
And we can blame eggnog, can't
yeah.
we?
Yeah. Maybe that's why I don't have any September birthdays in my family. Morning, Claire. I'm Rachel. It's my 54th birthday today, but also our 15-year-old son, Arlo. I've never quite forgiven him for stealing my limelight every year, but secretly quite like telling people about this quirky fact, says Mike, who's out running with the dog in Bath.
Good for you, Mike. Dan in Redditch says, listening to your discussion about September births being higher, both myself and my wife are teachers and we deliberately aimed at September births for our children, as this meant she got 12 months off for the price of 9 with the summer holidays. Now I see what you've done there. We also see the difference when children start school with younger and older children, and they should know, both teachers.
Yes, that was an issue we were talking about earlier, actually, whether you are more sort of academically successful. Certainly in the sporting world, I think people with September birthdays feature quite highly. Mm. Let's talk about the football now. The Europa League started last night with Manchester United stumbling 1-1 draw against the Dutch team FC Twente at Old Trafford. United manager Erik ten Hag has joined the complaint, saying that the best players are expected to participate in far too many games, and he reckons the game's quality is suffering as a result.
It was the game of their life. They fought for every yard, and we didn't. And yeah, 99% is not enough. You have to give 100%. You have to kill the game. You have to finish it off. And we are leading 1-0, and then it's coming an atmosphere and a team. We bring the game till the end, but you have to go for the second goal, then you kill the game.
Well, let's speak to The Athletic's Laurie Whitwell, who covers United, was at the game last night. What did you make of their performance, Laurie?
Hi, guys. I mean, familiar pattern, really, because for the first half, it was actually quite good and they took the lead. Christian Eriksen shot, really nice goal, but they didn't keep up the intensity, and FC Twente came quite strong in the second half. And I mean, the goal United conceded was really poor from a defensive point of view, because the right back for 20 ran through, you know, five United players pretty much, and then Eriksen dawdled on the ball, and Sam Lammers stole it from him and arrived into the box and put it past Onana in perhaps a too easy way from a goalkeeper perspective. But so overall, I mean, FC 20 are the team that are the lowest rank coefficient that they'll face at Old Trafford in the Europa League. So it's another sort of result that kind of continues this awkward start of the season for United.
Yeah, and in fact, I think Eriksen after the game said 20 wanted it more. So why is that hunger not there?
Yeah, it's a surprise, really, because they've sort of had really good moments this season. And again, last night they did sort of playing some nice stuff. But, I mean, I guess, you know, if they're playing too many games, maybe that's a part of it where they're sort of midway through the second half thinking, okay, we can kind of ease up a little bit here. But clearly Ten Hag was frustrated at that. And maybe he will reflect on the, you know, team that he picked and the substitutions he made, because obviously you need that freshness in the team. Maybe you could have made different changes.
Yeah. I mean, looking across the season so far for United, they've drawn twice, lost three games. There was a smattering of boos, I think, as well at the final whistle. Mm. Do you think you're beginning to see any kind of positive forward momentum under Ten Hag?
Yeah, I mean, there is sort of signs of hope, because they are creating, you know, good chances. Certainly at Selhurst Park on Saturday, I was there for that one as well, and they should really have won that game. You know, it was 0-0, but they created enough to win. Yeah, comfortably, really. And then again, last night, not as, sort of clinical, but they've got a good collection of young players. It's just that they haven't got that kind of guarantee of goals in the team. So you're kind of hoping rather than expecting them to, you know, produce these moments where they can go on a winning run. There's some flickers of hope, but again, if it continues on for too long, then the pressure will become too much, I think.
Yeah. And this whole discussion about whether players are playing too many games, I mean, it feels like a slight distraction perhaps from what's actually going on the pitch day to day, week to week. But do you think Ten Hag has a point there when it comes to United's performance? Obviously, all the teams are in the same boat, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's, you know, FA20, for example, you know, the Eredivisie has fewer teams in it, and I guess the pace of that league is less than the Premier League. You know, I think everyone comments on how intense the Premier League is when they join it for the first time, and so you can't, you know, let any game slip. You know, every opposition is going to be up for it, and I think that's maybe the crucial point here. But then again, you know, United have got a big squad, you know, spent a lot of money to make it have strength in depth, and so that, you know, it kind of has only so much weight, that argument. But I do, yeah, there's certainly a breaking point, I think, for the number of games that players are going to be asked to make, because, you know, the competitions, there's so many. When you look ahead to the next summer, the Club World Cup, United aren't in that. But, you know, I think there's certainly the expanded Europa League competition, which has got two more guaranteed games in this league phase. It's quite convoluted, so it's difficult to work out how significant that draw last night really was. So I think there's certainly a point there. But overall, United, the team of that scale and quality, should be beating FC20.
Cheers, Laurie. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Laurie Whitwell, who's from The Athletics, covers United for them. Loads more reaction to that game and all the other football from last night, the League Cup games as well, on the Five Live Football Daily podcast.
Yes, still to come. Keep your texts coming in, and plenty of you are on our In My Opinion this morning. Should we stop talking down the NHS? Just after 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Here are the news headlines. The UK has joined 10 other countries and the European Union in calling for a 21-day ceasefire on the Israel-Lebanon border after the recent escalation of fighting there. Excuse me. The call follows an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, during which the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said hell was breaking loose in Lebanon.
A woman has given the BBC a harrowing account of how she was raped at the age of 16 by the former Harrods owner Mohamed Fayed after being made to undergo intrusive medical examinations. Harrods' new owners have previously apologised unreservedly and say Fayed's actions were that of an individual intent on abusing his power.
Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. It's understood that customer data wasn't compromised.
And the Ministry of Justice says that almost 40 prisoners who'd breached restraining orders were wrongly let out of jail under the government's early release scheme. 32 of the 37 are now back in prison. Text here. My son was born 9 months exactly the date after my 30th birthday. So it's birthdays and Christmas, says Michael in Wellington.
Yes.
Twice a year, that's plenty.
Double celebration. Well, I mean, bullseye, quite literally. both times. I'm talking, you know, medically, Simon. Take that smirk off your face. here he is with the weather and a great cardigan. If you don't mind me saying, yeah, you're a man who can wear knitwear well.
Well, the knitwear is out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you'll definitely need it over the weekend as well, because it is going to turn colder.
The heating is on
in
our house. Have you
definitely
gone there?
Yeah,
the dial has turned.
Yeah. Yeah, but before we get the cold weather coming in, it's actually going to be very wet again for parts of England and Wales. We could once again see some localised flooding in some central and southern areas today. There'll be a lot of water falling in a short space of time. So that's the reason. The rain is really quite persistent at the moment in the northeast of England. Eventually, it's going to start to clear away from these northern areas of England, but into parts of North Wales, into the Midlands, where it's already raining at the moment. So there'll be further rain into the afternoon. For some central southern areas, well, a bit of rain around this morning, some heavy showers about, but as we go through the day, those showers will turn heavier. Some thunderstorms, torrential rain for some parts. In between that, there will be some sunny spells, quite windy around the English Channel. For Northern Ireland, central and southern Scotland, very wet this morning as well. That rain is going to gradually clear to the south. Sunshine for northern Scotland, gradually extending its way further southward. And temperatures about 9 to 13 degrees in the north, 14 to 18 in the south.
How are the roads looking out there, Ellie?
Not too bad. Just sort of your usual traffic this morning. We'll start at Derbyshire on the M1 southbound. You do have a lane closed there because of a broken down vehicle between junction 29 at Chesterfield and 28. Traffic is queuing because of that. The M1 southbound around Hertfordshire, there was an accident earlier at junction 8 for Hemel Hempstead. That has now been cleared, but still looking very slow back to junction 10. The M25 anti-clockwise, that is still closed between junction 28 at Brentwood to 27. There's been an accident there, so very long delays. You've got congestion to junction 30. The A12 at Brentwood is back to junction 13, and a 5 mile queue clockwise is being held at junction 28 for the emergency services to get through at the moment. So that is going to be very slow today. And the M2 westbound, that remains closed because of an accident at junction 1. You've got a couple of miles of queuing traffic, congestion to the Medway Viaduct. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
Ellie, thank you.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Just going to say, joining us after 8 o'clock, the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen's going to be here. And of course, this comes off the back of allies, including the US, UK and the EU, basically saying at the UN, we want a temporary ceasefire because Israel has said we feel we may be about to enter enemy territory. There's obviously everything that's happened in the last 12 months has escalated the tensions between the two countries. But this is a history that goes back decades. Whatever question you have for Jeremy Bowen, do text us 85058.
Katie's here with our sport this morning. Hello. We were talking about Manchester United actually just before the news, yeah, and mentioned the fact that there were some boos around Old Trafford last night.
Yeah, and I think fans, I mean, they're certainly not in full-blown mutiny mode yet. The club gave Ten Hag their backing after they won the FA Cup at the end of last season, but this was underwhelming a little. They drew 1-1 against Ten Hag's boyhood club Twente in the Europa League. There were some good elements of play, Christian Eriksen's goal, but so far this season, defensively, yes, looking better for sure, but there's still major concerns over the lack of goals they're scoring, looking a bit toothless at times. And I mean, it's never a good sign with players and the boss here saying that they felt the opposition wanted it more.
It was the game of their life. They fought for every yard. And yeah, we didn't. And yeah, 99% is not enough. You have to give 100%. You have to kill the game. You have to finish it off.
There's an interesting write-up actually on the BBC Sport website this morning you can check out with a great breakdown of looking at United's season start so far versus the last two under Ten Hag and how the numbers add up, and you can kind of make some conclusions yourself. Holders Liverpool are through to the fourth round of the League Cup. That was after a 5-1 win over West Ham at Anfield. So they're going to take on Brighton next, while Arsenal have Preston. That is after they dispatch with League One Bolton 5-1. 17-year-old Ethan Werneri scoring twice, and his boss, Mikel Arteta, says the teenager has settled into the first team football like a duck to water.
He's making the right steps. He's part of us now. He's doing really, really well in training. He's under respect of all his teammates, and he's playing, you can tell, with a lot of presence, confidence, belief, and for sure the quality that he has.
And also a reminder, Arsenal women in a big game tonight. It's must win in their second leg of their Champions League qualifying match, trailing Hecken by 1-0.
Do you think, just talking about Wanneri, do you think Lee Carsley's going to be sniffing around him soon?
Yeah, he's already playing the age group, England.
Under 20,
yeah,
under 20s, would it be?
I'm trying to think which one that would be. We'll have a look. But he certainly has represented England. But he's one of those.
He's represented them at the under 17 level.
Yeah, so he's also in the under 19 squad at the moment.
Right. So Carsey will know him well then, won't he?
Well, exactly. And that's, I suppose, you know, going off track a bit here, but that's exactly why Carsey has kind of got that sort of influence with those younger players that we already see being brought through, haven't we, with like Angel Gomez, etc.
So still plenty of reaction coming into last weekend's Anthony Joshua Daniel Dubois fight, which ended like this.
A blistering right hand had deposited Anthony Joshua on the canvas. A towel has come in from Ben Davison, and this contest is over.
And we spoke to Frank Warren in the week, but actually it's not what was happening necessarily in the ring directly that's causing some further controversy.
Yeah, so it's been Saudi involvement back in the spotlight. So even though the fight took place at Wembley in London, it falls under this Riyadh season umbrella of events, so organised by Saudi organisers. That means you had this much discussed moment. I think we talked about it, didn't we, where the Saudi national anthem was played ahead of the fight. Mm. And there were a lot of Saudi themed fan events going on as well. Now, many critics claim that Saudi investment in boxing is to gain legitimacy, to deflect attention away from controversies over its human rights record, which is a practice known as sports washing. And it does raise a lot of concerns for a lot of people. Yesterday, promoters, Warren, you mentioned there, Eddie Hearn as well, both defended it. So they said specifically it enabled the Dubois-Joshua fight to happen and that it was the shot in the arm that British boxing needed. So it was the first Riyadh season fight to happen in the UK. Obviously, the interesting question will be whether we see more and more of this happening. Elsewhere in cricket, England say Test captain Ben Stokes is on track after his hamstring injury to be part of the series against Pakistan. So he's set to be with the team. They travel on Tuesday. The first test begins in 12 days' time. Mark Selby, John Higgins and reigning world champion Kyron Wilson all progressed at the British Open snooker yesterday. And I just wanted to bring you an update on a story we brought you last week. So this is involving Japanese MLB baseball superstar Shohei Ohtani, the guy who was on the 10-year, $700 million contract. So we talked about this last week. He claimed a historic 50th home run of the season for LA Dodgers, making him the first player to ever do that and steal 50 bases in a season. Well, they finally tracked down the ball that he hit in that historic moment. It's been put up for auction. The starting bid is $375,000, $500 million.
What?
But there is an option, guys, is ready, to purchase it privately for £3.4 million.
A bit like the buy it now on eBay.
Exactly. So it could be yours, Rach.
Or make an offer. You know, we could combine it. Unlikely.
Yeah, a little kitty.
He even left the full resources of everyone in this studio.
Big kitty.
Thank you, Katie.
Yes, it is. 19 minutes to 8 now on Five Live Breakfast. Rachel and Claire with you. Keep those questions coming in for our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who's going to be joining us after 8 o'clock, 85058, on Lebanon, because the UN Security General is warning that hell has broken loose in Lebanon. It comes as allies, including the US, UK and EU, have called for a 21-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Last night's emergency session of the UN Security Council heard warnings about the risks of all-out regional war. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, is in northern Israel for us. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. Calls for a ceasefire because there's genuine concern about the noises coming from the Israeli side about a potential land invasion.
Yeah, good morning. I mean, we've had warning signs from both sides. I mean, yesterday, Hezbollah fired a single ballistic missile which reached Tel Aviv before being intercepted. That was a pretty emphatic reminder of Hezbollah's capability, even after the disastrous 10 days that it's had. And of course, as you say, the Israelis also warning that they could escalate by sending troops in on the ground. Now, I should say that for the last 12 hours or so, we have had no alerts at all. It is completely quiet here in northern Israel this morning. I'm about 20 miles from the border. We can hear nothing. There are no rockets in the sky, no Iron Dome interceptors streaking overhead, none of that. Now, way too early to draw any conclusions. All of that could come to a halt, at a moment's notice. But at a time when there are these international calls for some kind of ceasefire, it is perhaps telling that we're not at the moment hearing the sounds of war.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this is all part, understandably, of the Israel government's plan to allow people back into northern Israel. So just remind us, since October the 7th last year, when Hezbollah stepped into this fight as well over what was happening in Gaza, how that has affected people in northern Israel.
Oh, it's had a huge impact. So I'm speaking to you from Kibbutz Lavi. That's a kibbutz just a little distance west of Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. And this has been home for the past 11 months, almost 12 months, to around 200 people displaced from all over the northern border, from Kiryat Shmona, from some of the tiny little communities that literally sit precariously close to the border. People came down here thinking that they might have to be here for a few weeks or perhaps a few months. They've now been here for the best part of a year, and they don't know when they're going to go home. And you're right, the Israeli government says that is now one of its principal war aims, to make sure that they are able to go home. And that will only be possible, Israeli officials tell you over and over again, when all manifestations of a threat from Hezbollah have been removed. And that, in the words of Israeli military folk we were talking to yesterday, means that Hezbollah simply has to move all of its men and equipment way back from the border to close to the Litani River, which is quite a long distance into southern Lebanon. And something, by the way, that the UN demanded that they do after the last big round of fighting in 2006. So anything short of that result is going to meet stiff opposition here in Israel. And certainly quite a number of politicians this morning and overnight have been quoted as saying that the campaign in the north should continue. That talk of a ceasefire for 21 days, which is being mooted, is too long. It runs the risk of allowing Hezbollah to regroup. And so one way or another, through diplomacy or brute force, Israel is very, very determined to achieve that aim.
And I guess the challenge for the UN and everybody doing the diplomacy behind the scenes is whether you can separate the two, whether you can convince Hezbollah to separate the action and further strikes and go back to that prearranged point that was agreed by this UN resolution in 2006. If you can separate that from what is going on in Gaza, and that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge question. And, you know, for the last several weeks, we've almost stopped. I mean, this is awful to say, but we've almost stopped paying attention to events in Gaza where the war does go on and where negotiations over a ceasefire and the release of Israeli hostages seems to have run into the sand. There is this diplomatic effort which seems intent on restoring that link and making sure that a ceasefire can take place on both fronts. I think Israel has been quite keen in the last 2 to 3 weeks to see, for all of us to see, the Lebanon war as an entirely separate matter. It doesn't want that linkage at all. But it's worth reminding listeners that, you know, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, the Shiite militias in Iraq who launched a few drones at Israel last night, they all say that if the war in Gaza ends, this current round of hostilities around the region comes to an end too.
Paul, thank you so much for the update. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, as he was telling us, just about 20 miles south of the border with Lebanon in northern Israel. Keep those questions coming in for Jeremy Bowen. He'll join us after 8, 8:50, 5:08. 14 minutes to 8.
This weekend on BBC Radio 5 Live.
On Sunday, Manchester United take on Spurs on 5 Live Premier League Sunday.
And the ball does go.
And on Saturday, there's updates from around the grounds, as well as live commentary of Arsenal versus Leicester at 3 and Wolves versus Liverpool at 5:30.
Tees it up, left foot, oh, he scored!
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
5 Live Breakfast.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
So today's In My Opinion is all about the NHS and the kind of language we use when we describe it. And the question is the government being too harsh? The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, keeps calling it broken. At the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, he has said, "I won't back down. The NHS is broken, but it's not beaten. And together we will turn it around." Well, he used the example of Claire, a cancer patient who contacted him earlier this year and used private health insurance for the first time in her life after being diagnosed.
When she felt pain 2 years ago, she struggled to get diagnosed. Her employer provides private health insurance, and for the first time in her life, Claire used it. Had she stayed with the NHS, Claire is certain she'd be dead.
Well, it was a really stark message from him. Let's speak to Roy Lilly, health commentator, who's with us for today's In My Opinion. Hello, Roy.
Good morning.
I mean, that was quite an arresting story, wasn't it? And you can understand when he's getting messages like that, why he feels it's his duty as health secretary to say, this isn't working at the moment.
Yes, and I think you're right, and there are ways of saying it. I mean, it's certainly true that the NHS has accumulated a whole load of problems that were made clear in the Darzi report that came out two or three weeks ago. The impact of 10 years of flatline funding during the austerity period, COVID, a chaotic reorganisation, and Brexit hasn't helped with staff. A lot of staff have gone home. So, yes, the NHS is struggling. And I think, you know, in the knockabout of an election campaign, saying the NHS is broken, it's a soundbite, nobody takes it too seriously. But to keep saying it, I think, has a very deleterious effect on people's morale working in the NHS. It makes the public wonder if the NHS is going to be there for them. And a million people today will be looked after by the NHS. And, you know, hopefully they'll all have a satisfactory experience and go home feeling better or well or whatever it is that they've had done. But to keep on hammering this home, I think it lacks some maturity. I think what Labour
if I can finish my point. Okay.
If Labour have to realise that they're not in opposition anymore. It's not about slogans. Your government is about getting things done.
No, but it is
and
about...
there is no plan to get things done.
It is about adequately. It is about adequately explaining the scale of the problem. And if that's what he sees, there tends to be around the NHS this kind of kid gloves approach that we can't ever criticise it. But
I don't think that's true at all.
No.
If you look at the Darzi report, you can't possibly say that was kid gloves. And everyone working in the NHS on a ward today knows exactly what the problems are. But I think what we want from government is not now a whole series of slogans. We want to know what the government's going to do. Now, at the moment, the best that Wes Streeting seems to have to offer is to try and encourage people to do a bit of overtime to reduce the 7.6 million people on the waiting list. And we've got to wait till next spring until they finish writing a 10-year plan. Well, that's not getting things done, in my view. They gave us the impression when they were in opposition looking for our votes that they had a sleeves rolled up solution, that they would put the pedal to the metal and they would get things done. But standing on a stage a Labour Party conference is it's all a bit of a knockabout. But I think the time has come now for the government to tell us, okay, what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? And when are you going to do it?
Wes Streeting, whenever we interviewed him in the election campaign, was very keen to tell us about the 7-day-week operating theatres that were set up in one particular hospital. I think it was Guy's and Thomas's.
Yes, high intensity lists.
And he was pretty confident that these were going to be rolled out in other parts of the country. I don't know whether that has happened. But if I can make another point, just a question, because this is a discussion and we want people to share their views as well. 85058. Is there some value in encouraging people to really appreciate the NHS, in acknowledging its fragility? Because it is a stretched resource. It is asked to do so much more than it was ever intended to do, than it was set up to do however many decades ago. And unless we kind of make people aware that this is something we really need to take care of, that it is a precious vase and we all have our part to play in that, it won't survive the next 10 years.
Well, I think there's a sort of an offshoot of that, and I think it is a sensible approach. And I think it is the fact that we've got to stop people getting sick in the first place. 60% of presentations in primary care, first presentations in primary care, are people with lifestyle-related problems. And so how we live our lives, what we eat, what we drink, when we exercise and when we sit on the sofa are important parts of how well we are. So the population wellness is a really important thing. And I think getting home to people that they can do their bit by trying to do the things that keep them well will be a big contribution to the NHS managing itself in the future. And it's not just the NHS. I mean, if you look at the population health right across Europe, all of the developed healthcare systems are having the same problem. They've all got lifestyle related problems and are being, you know, a huge increase in the number of presentations. So yes, you're right. We should do our bit and we should try and lead a healthy life.
Yeah. Tell me about staff morale, because you worked in the NHS, Roy. You're embedded in the health service in many years, got huge experience. What are people telling you about that right now?
Well, I suppose, you know, they're knackered is the my initial response. People are really knackered. And the effect of working through COVID is still a huge shadow that hangs over a lot of people. I mean, the NHS is used to death, and it's used to emotion, and it's used to disaster. But the death on an industrial scale during COVID left a fingerprint on a lot of people's experiences, and they still carry that with them today. And there's a huge amount of frustration. I mean, things like logging on to a ward-based computer that takes 8 or 9 minutes for the thing to whirl through the system. I mean, all of that drives people balmy. So I think, but there's still a huge commitment to the NHS. You know, people want the NHS to work.
Yeah.
And they want the investment. And when people say, oh, we need to reform the NHS. You know, if the NHS is broken, it's been broken by politicians and the decisions they've made to invest or not invest. They have broken the NHS if it is broken. And now I think people in the NHS are saying, well, what are you going to do to unbreak it? What are you going to do? How are you going to invest? I mean, some of the ways in which the NHS work, it's pencil and paper and Neanderthal, frankly, and everybody's crying out for reform. There is no resistance from the NHS to reform. They want it as much as everybody else.
You make a great case, Roy, and thanks very much as ever for coming on the show. That's Roy Lilly. He's a health commentator. Loads of you getting in touch about this. The NHS is broken, says Kevin in South Staffordshire. Clinical and treatment areas are great, but the administration is unfit for purpose. That's the area that is in need of change. This one, the NHS is not broken. The media and politicians ignore expert review after expert review that say increases in funding are what's required for social as well as healthcare. Saying we can't afford the required tax rises is doublespeak. Another one here, broken NHS language causes moral injury for those of us working in it. Stop telling us we are broken. Help us fix it.
Keep them coming in, 85058. It is just after 5 minutes to eight. We love you, Europe. That is the message commuters received when logging onto the Wi-Fi at some train stations last night. London Euston, Manchester Piccadilly and 11 other stations managed by Network Rail appear to have had their Wi-Fi hacked by a third party. Here's our reporter Simon Jones.
Well, some of the really big stations such as Manchester Piccadilly, Liverpool Lime Street, Birmingham New Street stations run by Network Rail. Now, normally if you try to get on the Wi-Fi at a railway station, you get an introductory screen, you tick a box to say you agree to the terms and conditions, and then if things are working, you can start your browsing. But in this case, actually, when people tried to get on the Wi-Fi, they got that message, we love you, Europe. And then actually, it was followed by some details about recent terror attacks, both in the UK and abroad. So it's actually thought this was an anti-Islamic message. Now, I was down at London Euston Station overnight, and I tried to get on the Wi-Fi, and simply, it wasn't there. So it's been switched off, it's suspended. And I think it's going to remain that way until Network Rail can work out who's behind this and how they actually got into the system.
Simon Jones, our reporter there, with more on that particular story. Now, do you remember what you were doing last Christmas? Because we're talking birthdays today and why it's common today, more common than normal days, to give birth. Our reporter, Tim Muffett, is on a maternity ward at the Royal Surrey Hospital. Tim, good morning. It's a busy day today. We've kind of tied it back into activity, shall we say, around Christmas time. So how are staff feeling there about their busy day ahead?
Yeah, good morning to you. Well, as you say, the Office for National Statistics crunches its data and works out which day is the most likely day on which to be born. And over the past 20 years or so, some years it's been September the 26th today, some years September the 27th, but it always tends to be the last week in September, the most popular time of year to be born. Before I talk to a midwife, I'm going to quickly chat to Amelia, who's just 2 days ago gave birth to Freya and Isla. They are absolutely beautiful, 2 days old, just in front of me now, fast asleep and blissfully unaware of a radio reporter asking questions to their mother. But Amelia, how are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm doing really well, thank you. The care has been really, really good. So, I mean, recovery's been amazing. And it means that I've just had my girls with me the whole time since they were born, which is, amazing, really.
Well, congratulations. They are absolutely gorgeous. Let's have a quick chat to Claire Cardew, who's the head midwife here. Claire, what's it like this time of year and why do you think it's so busy?
September is always notoriously a busy time of year for maternity services, not just at the Royal Surrey, I think across the country. I think there's lots of theories for that. Sometimes I've heard that women like to plan to have a baby that's in the older part of the school year, so there's advantages to that. So I think that's one of the theories, but it is always busy, but we plan for it, we can predict it, and we've got the right staffing to make sure we can meet those demands.
Now, many maternity units are struggling and have received poor ratings from the Care Quality Commission. This one has been rated outstanding.
That's right.
What do you do well here, which maybe some others aren't doing so well?
I could talk about lots of things. I think the thing I'd focus on, one of the things, is that we really try to listen to the experience that women have and to use that feedback to really inform how we develop and improve our services. I think one of the examples of that is that we've developed our education resources. So we've got lots of different resources for women to use. And that's one of the things that I think we're really proud of.
Claire, thanks so much indeed. Well, it's a busy time of year, but from the maternity unit at the Royal Surrey County Hospital, back to you.
Tim, thanks very much indeed. Tell us why we should give you a shout out if it's your birthday today. Rebecca says, morning Claire and Rachel, it's my 39th birthday today. Hurrah. Spent the night in A&E with my mum, who eventually agreed to go in, only to find she had a chest infection, kidney infection, sepsis as well. Lucky she's improving and I'm heading home for a sleep. Happy birthday, Rebecca.
And wish your mum all the best.
Yeah,
as
we
well.
Really
from
do.
Us. Take care.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told an emergency meeting of the Security Council that all hell is breaking loose in Lebanon following days of cross-border fire and missile strikes. Israel's most senior general has told his troops to be ready to go into Lebanon to fight Hezbollah on the ground. Mr. Guterres has called for an immediate end to the hostilities and says another conflict needs to be prevented.
All-out war must be avoided at all costs. It would surely be an all-out catastrophe. The people of Lebanon, as well as the people of Israel and the people of the world, cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
There's been a prolonged drone strike in the Ukrainian capital Kyiv overnight as President Zelensky seeks permission to use long-range Western-made missiles against military targets in Russia. The Ukrainian leader will meet President Biden in New York later. Yesterday, President Putin reiterated that Russia reserves the right to use nuclear weapons if it is attacked by any state.
Network Rail says there's been a cyber attack on the public Wi-Fi network at 20 railway stations. Customers directed to websites containing what the company called inappropriate material before their Wi-Fi was suspended. An investigation into what happened is underway.
The Ministry of Justice says almost 40 prisoners who breached restraining orders were wrongly let out under the government's early release scheme. 32 of the 37 are now back in jail. Ministers say they're working urgently to get the last five back into custody. Nick Hardwick is a former chief inspector of prisons.
People who were, many were guilty of breach a restraining order under current legislation were barred from early release, but men had committed the same offence but under previous legislation weren't included.
The mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, is facing federal criminal charges. The details haven't been revealed, but he is under investigation for campaign funding violations. He would be the first sitting mayor of the city to be charged, but insists he's done nothing wrong.
And Chinese scientists say they have discovered the world's oldest known cheese dating back 3,500 years. The researchers analysed dairy science.